That's a legendary Mario Bauza and his Afro-Cuban jazz orchestra with El Manicero, the peanut vendor. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Friday, January the 4th, and the House of Representatives today passed a $9.7 billion measure to pay for Superstorm Sandy flood insurance claims. The bill now goes to the Senate for approval. A full $60 billion storm relief package was to have been approved this past Wednesday, but political wrangling behind the scenes resulted in it getting shelved at the last minute. So the House will take up that piece of legislation, it is expected, on January the 15th. A chastened John Boehner, narrowly reelected yesterday for a second term as Speaker of the House, says he will have no more closed-door one-on-one meetings with President Obama. Boehner, as you know, has been raked over the coals by fellow Republicans who say he all but gave away the store during fiscal cliff negotiations with the president and was autocratic about it, shutting them out of the process. After Boehner's alternative Plan B was rejected by Obama and a humiliated Boehner abandoned negotiations, the final deficit reduction plan was first passed in the Democrat-controlled Senate and then forced upon the Republican-controlled House. The bill did finally pass in the House, but Republicans largely opposed it. A spokesman for Boehner says the re-elected speaker is committed to working through regular order and letting the House work its will, unquote. Well, that sounds nice and good, but Boehner's re-election itself is proof that old-style politics is the regular order. Though unhappy with him, no one dared to oppose Boehner. He ran unopposed. 17 GOP votes were needed to force either a second ballot or to make him withdraw, but only 12 broke rank. Boehner won 220 to 192, and it was a voice vote, meaning people actually had to say yay or nay, clearly identifiable among their peers, not by secret ballot. So that was a smart move by Mr. Boehner. Because as Speaker, you see, he controls committee assignments. He controls those whose legislation should come to the floor for a vote. He controls where party money goes in re-election campaigns. And he is a big help to people running for re-election as incumbents. He helps with fundraising. And that's why a guy who has teed off his party is re-elected Speaker of the House. It's the old political principle of you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. 'Tis the season, it seems, for billion-dollar fines. Maybe it's part of the federal government's new plan to close the budget gap. The latest fine payer is Transocean, which owned the Deepwater Horizon oil rig that exploded on April the 20th in 2010, killing 11 workers. The rig was leased by BP, British Petroleum. Transocean, based in Switzerland, has agreed to settle. I like that phrase, has agreed to settle with the U.S. government, in which it will pay $400 million in criminal penalties and a $1 billion civil fine after pleading guilty to violating the Clean Water Act. The oil spill, as you remember, damaged the Gulf of Mexico coast, causing one of the biggest environmental disasters in U.S. history. I thought I would bring to your attention something that struck me because an anniversary of sorts is coming up next week. On December the 7th, that is next Monday. I mean, not December 7th, I'm sorry, we passed it. On December the 7th, 1993. In late summer of 93, I was the editor of a newspaper then, and the receptionist called me and said there was somebody at the door to see me. And although we were on deadline, I said, sure, fine. The person didn't have an appointment or anything like that. And this young man came into the editorial office, and we started to talk. Our editorial office was just one big room. We all sat in the same big room. And he sat at my desk, and immediately I could tell that he was a very tightly wound person, but exceedingly polite, very, very polite, very deferential, very, you could tell that he was agitated, but very controlled. And he said, the first thing he said was, I want to thank you for allowing me to interrupt your work day. I said, oh, no, not at all. What are you here for? What can I help you with? And he started to tell me about his trouble, and his trouble was that he felt he was being pushed around. He was in college, and he had gotten some really bad grades for work he thought that was exceptional and did not deserve the bad grades that he was getting and that he had gotten, and that it affected his GPA, his grade point average. And he wanted to do something about it, and he was thinking of suing. But then he went to lawyer after lawyer after lawyer, and they gave him a song and dance, and he just wanted this thing exposed because he had put so much effort and energy into his schoolwork, and he just felt that he was getting shafted. And he was very clear that it was, in his mind, because of racism. I said, well, how long had it been going on? He said it had been going on all semester long, and he couldn't stand it anymore. I said, well, tell you what. I identify with that because I've had the experience myself where papers that I had done that were really exceptional. I did have an issue with one of my professors, and I, in fact, had to sue or threaten to sue through a lawyer to get the grade reviewed, and it was reviewed and changed. I said, well, can I get us an idea of the work that you were doing? Can I see something to give me an idea of what you were talking about? And he said, you know, I don't have any of the papers with me, but I'll gladly bring them back and show them to you. I said, well, that's good. Why don't you do that? And I'll take a look at them and see for myself, you know, what you're talking about. I used to teach at college myself, so I felt for him. But I could tell that this was something that had disturbed him greatly. And then he reached into his pocket and he took out a wad of loose leaf paper that he had written on and a lot of notes. And he showed me a list of all the people that he had gone to talk about this thing and who had basically dismissed him. Nobody paid him any mind. And he checked off these names and he crossed the names out and he said, these are the people I'd been to. And they're black, many of them are black, and they don't want to talk to me. They call themselves civil rights leaders and they don't want to talk to me. And I've been to every single one. In fact, I've just come from, and he named the person, he went to two lawyers, he said, just before coming to my office. I said, well, look, the first thing is to really get a sense of, did anybody read any of your papers? He said, no, nobody had read his papers. I said, why don't we do this? Come back and bring me an example of one of your term papers, and I'd like to really take a look at it. And he said, Well, that's good. Thank you so much. I really want to thank you for this. I really, really want to thank you. And he kept saying, I want to thank you. I want to thank you. I said, it's no trouble, no trouble at all. And with that, he left. And a couple of months later, there was this flash. It was in December of 93. When I saw him, it was in the summer of 93. And in December of 93, the news flash concerned a person who had shot and killed 6 people on the Long Island Railroad and injured 19 others. And it was the same person who had come to see me. It was Colin Ferguson. And I thought of Colin Ferguson when the situation in Newtown, Connecticut occurred. And I thought I would draw, you know, look at how these cases were handled. Colin Ferguson, even to me as a, you know, I was just going by my fast impression of what he presented. And he clearly presented himself as a very agitated person. He was wringing his hands and he was very intense. And I could tell that he was seriously angry. He was very, very angry. And so I matched his demeanor with a sense of calm, and it seemed to calm him down. And when I said, I will read your papers, let me see your papers, let me get a sense of what was happening. And he seemed so relieved about that. But there was no doubt in my mind that he was an extremely agitated man. Not just angry, but beyond that. He had gone at a point beyond that. He complained about being rejected. He complained about racism. He complained about the so-called leaders of the community not even wanting to pay him any attention or to listen to what he had to say. And he produced this long list of a bunch of people he had been to. And when this shooting occurred on the Long Island Railroad, and I saw the person, I said, my God, that is the same person who came to see me, Colin Ferguson. But in the processing of this particular case, Colin Ferguson was not handled or even looked upon by the criminal justice system as a person who had a mental illness or who might have been mentally ill at the time he committed, even though his lawyers at the time, it was Ron Kuby, it was Bill Kunstler, the late Bill Kunstler, and his partner Ron Kuby, who took the case on pro bono. And they did everything to impress upon the court that their client was mentally ill and that they needed some time to prepare his case. And of course, they were denied. They actually ended up having to walk away from the case. They didn't feel that they could continue to represent him. And in fact, Colin Ferguson even demonstrated his mental illness by insisting on representing himself in this awful situation. And the court allowed it. And if you, in any way, monitored that trial, it became a sick joke of Colin Ferguson cross-examining witnesses, speaking and referring to himself in the third person. And it became a very sick joke. And he was looked upon as literally, they called him an animal. They called him all kinds of things, except saying that there was a possibility that this person was not in his right mind. Now, I'm not excusing, understand my point here, I'm not excusing the fact that 6 people were killed, shot dead, and 19 others wounded. Not at all. But I'm saying that this person was absolutely mentally ill, at least to my own novice appraisal. I could see that. And his lawyers insisted that he was. But the court would not recognize him as that because everybody wanted his blood. Here was a black man who killed and shot at all these white people on a train. And he was a Caribbean man. And he did not get in any way recognition from the court, from the criminal justice system, or from even the people who are the scientists. Do you know, a psychiatrist actually said to the court that he was fit for trial. And anybody could have seen that Colin Ferguson was not in his right mind. He became paranoid. He became, he was just explosive. And he would alternate between these fits of rage and absolute calm and control. And I might have seen him in just at the edge of that. But at the time when he left, he was very deferential to me, very, very exceedingly polite. The end result is that he was convicted in 95 of murder for the deaths of the 6 people who were killed right in the train car. And he was also charged with attempted murder for wounding the other 19 passengers. And the state got its pound of flesh, and he is serving a 315 years and 8 months to life sentence. He's incarcerated, still not being treated. But he was clearly a person with a serious problem. And then I look at the Aurora, Colorado shooting and the treatment of James Egan Holmes, the young man who killed 12 people and injured 58 others on that night and Friday, July the 20th, at a movie theater. People going to see the midnight screening of The Dark Knight Rises. And Holmes comes into the theater and just fires off all these rounds from his high-powered weapons and mows them down. And the very first thing that people said, I'm talking about now the officials and the prosecutorial system and everybody else, said, well, there's something wrong with this young man. And in fact, that is how he's being treated, as a person who was not in his right mind. And as awful as the crime was, as devastating as its impact was and still is, Holmes himself is regarded almost as an unfortunate person who, despite his brilliance academically, was just out of his mind. And we're now hearing stories about how he was seeing a psychiatrist. We're hearing stories about people commenting how withdrawn he was or odd in his behavior, how he had gone through these different moods and so forth. But in any event, the killer, the mass killer here, Holmes, despite the fact that it was a grave crime that he committed, still he is afforded that, he's afforded the courtesy, if you will, of a fair trial. The courtesy of saying, well, is this a person who just was hell-bent on just killing people for killing's sake? Or is this a troubled person? The consensus seems to be, even among the families of victims, that this is a person who was out of his mind. And so he will be accorded an entirely different treatment. Even if he's convicted, he will be accorded an entirely different treatment even after conviction. Not just thrown in a cell and said, we'll see you in 315 years and 8 months. But there would be an effort to make him whole because he is seen as a damaged person. And then comes Newtown, Connecticut, and Adam Lanza, the 20-year-old who just went on the shooting spree, killing first his mother, Nancy, in her home, and then going to the Sandy Hook Elementary School in the village of Sandy Hook and killing all these children, 20 children, 6 adults, and then finally himself. Even in death, the first thing that people said was he was out of his mind. And there's no doubt in my mind that had he, in fact, lived, had he not killed himself, had he, in fact, been captured, even though this was an extraordinarily horrific crime, he would have been dealt with differently, not as an animal, not as a savage, but as a person who himself was lost in his own mind. He was a lost soul. He was not in his right mind. So we have these points of reference. And it dawned on me because I actually had contact. This person, Colin Ferguson, actually came to see me. We spent quite a while in the office talking. And I spent a lot of time talking with him because I could tell when he came in, he was so agitated. And when it, of course, turned out that the killer on the Long Island Railroad was, in fact, the same Colin Ferguson who came to see me, the receptionist said to me, oh my God, could you imagine that? I said, well, you know, this is life. This is how it works. I could tell he was really wound up, but I could tell it was not your basic agitation. It was not just, you know, the rigors of the day. This person had gone to another extreme, and I can tell that, and that is why I spent time to calm him down and to just engage him, to kind of find out what it was that really set him off that day. And like I said, he showed nothing but absolute politeness and very gentlemanly behavior. But just the same, I could tell there was something wrong here. So the criminal justice system and society at large, you know, there's this dichotomy in the way we look at people, literally by virtue of their race, their skin color, their culture, ethnicity. In Aurora, in Newtown, Connecticut, the enormity of the crimes, notwithstanding, the assessment still is that the agent of these crimes, these horrific crimes, still was a person who had to be viewed as a person incapacitated, mentally incapacitated, the agent of a great deal of horror and pain, yes, but a person at the time that this crime was committed who was not mentally in charge of himself. Colin Ferguson, every effort was made to deny the fact that there was any mental disorder there, to insist that he was just a depraved animal out to kill white people because he hated white people. And Colin Ferguson was made to bear the brunt of all of the dissatisfaction, the racial dissatisfaction that whites had with blacks. And made him the symbol of a modern day, it was a modern day lynching, I would say. It's no exaggeration to say that. To have a judge say that this man should represent himself, and then they carried it live almost like a joke. This was comedy, a bizarre kind of comedy, watching this man literally out of his mind, referring to himself constantly in the third person and questioning witnesses, you know, thinking that he was, in fact, doing the right thing for himself. His lawyers unable to persuade the court that the court ought to allow them the time to give him sufficient time to assess, properly assess, to have somebody properly assess his mental state. And then the state finding a psychiatrist who said he's absolutely competent to stand trial. He's absolutely competent enough to even defend himself. But then again, I covered a case in the Bronx, this is many, many years ago, of a psychiatrist who was called in by a SWAT team, and the SWAT team was there to evict a 68-year-old grandmother named Eleanor Bumpers from her subsidized apartment in the Bronx. She was alone, and she heard this attempt at forcible entry into her apartment. And she apparently just was screaming because she thought she was going to be killed. She thought somebody was trying to get in to kill her. And in the end, they did just that. To justify the use of force, they called in a psychiatrist who, from the hallway, asked her one or two questions from the hallway and determined that she was out of her mind. And so the SWAT team had what it needed to forcibly enter her apartment to evict her. And in the process of defending herself, she ran and got a kitchen knife, a 68-year-old arthritic woman. And I remembered I had never seen an apartment with so many holes in the wall. They shot her several times at close proximity with shotguns. And that is how we are seen. African Americans, people of color seen, that there isn't any need to be human about it. Colin Ferguson was not a human being. He was an animal, they said. Adam Lanza, however, was a lost soul. He was a lost soul. And James Holmes in Aurora was a very good student who suddenly took a turn for the worse. I'll take your calls at 888-874-4888, and we'll come back right after this break. It's Mario Balza on Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And the number is 888-874-4888. I just wanted to bring that to your attention because it occurred to me how differently these cases were being handled. An extraordinary comparison. Very, very much so. What are your thoughts today? Next week, I want to start, while I'm waiting for you, next week we're going to start a feature in which we will be having debates on the air. I'll give you homework assignments. Yes, there'll be homework. This is what I used to do, give homework, tell you the topic to prepare for, or topics you may choose, and then we'll couple you with another person, and you will make your case, either pro or con, and you'll be rated and we'll see who won the debate in the small truncated time in which you will be able to make your case on a particular subject. So that starts next week. Also, we're going to be taking a look at small projects all over the country where people are doing very important things, little things, to make changes in their communities. And ways in which we could support that. For example, it may just be a matter of replicating the project. I referred to the project in Brooklyn on State Street, where people just started planting flowers and prettying up their neighborhoods, and that actually saved an entire neighborhood. And that is easily duplicated. So all these things we begin to do because, you know, you find that people would say a number of things are critical of a system, but not themselves willing to commit to doing a lot of work. But it's okay. That's all right. We all can do something. So we will find out what it is that you can do, a small something that would make a qualitative difference in the lives of a person or people or a community. And so we could get into the habit of being integrated into, well, I don't want to say the word movement necessarily, but into activities that benefit and uplift people. So that is very important to me. So we'll start some of that as well. And we want to encourage reading. I would be recommending some books or tracts, and of course not just me, but people are sending me things as well that are quite useful in helping me even shape programs around it. So these things would help us all. So I'm open to that as well. And of course, to reach me, it's very easy to continue the discussion, and it is Lead Stories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com. Lead Stories at gmail.com. I really do appreciate your kind words and your suggestions and your points of view. On this topic also, you know, these things disturb me. I saw a story in the New York Times on January the 2nd, actually. And it, of course, dealt with the issue of gun control in an indirect way. It talked about homicide rates in Chicago, the city of Chicago. In fact, the headline said, "A soaring homicide rate, a divide in Chicago." It was written by Monica Davey. And The article talks about the unusually high rates of homicide in the city of Chicago and drew a correlation between not only the incidence of homicide, but where the homicides were occurring, and even drew up a table to show that the homicides, of course, were occurring in particular neighborhoods that had a particular profile. These were predominantly African-American communities, low income, or the higher the income, the lower the incidence of homicide. They even drew a correlation between the homicides and educational attainment, and compared the different ethnic groups and rates of homicide in these groups. And of course, the African-American community, which was the reason for the article, was leading all ethnic groups in the rates of homicide. Well, I think the writer meant well to show that this was a problem, the homicide rate, and the homicide rate by guns. But A, it's nothing new, and B, it neglects a number of things. And when we look at these issues for the mere pathology of it, without looking at a number of causes and a number of other correlations, if you lift it out of its proper environment, you see it just like, people just shooting and killing each other. But if you see Chicago as, and you understand the development of the city of Chicago, then you see the problem as you would interpret it in any other major city, because most other major cities developed the same way. That is, in a trenchantly racist way. People of color, immigrants, etc. And the city of Chicago is just like Philadelphia, just like New York City, just like Washington, D.C., just like Los Angeles in that regard. People were literally deprived of equal access to the strategic resources of society. Is it uncommon that people will kill people if they want things and they don't have a way of getting them, and they try in other ways to attain them? But this is the law of the land, and it's not unique to African Americans. This is what happens in all communities that are historically oppressed. Oppressed communities behave this way. And it is the nature of this kind of crime that people tend to kill each other. People tend to kill people they know. People tend to commit crimes in their communities. So when you present this as being almost exclusive to the African-American community, you're doing a disservice. And I wish reporters would stop going down that predictable path. It is the nature of homicide that the killer and the person being killed most often know each other. Mass killings are a whole different kettle of fish. It is the nature of crimes, of property crimes, that people would tend to commit crimes within a certain area from where they live. I mean, that is just the nature of crime. It is also the nature of crime that, especially in the urban communities, where you have a class of people with no hope, absolutely no hope. They don't have jobs. They don't have the possibility of jobs. They don't attend schools that are properly served. They do not get the best education. Right now, for example, the unemployment rate among African-American teenagers in some communities is well into the 80 and 90 percentile. People would not believe that. But even if a kid wanted to work, it would be an extraordinary thing to have that child take on something innovative all by him or herself to make a living. But when we yield to these I call them race baited reporting, you're not telling us anything new. Poor people commit crimes, rich people commit crimes. They commit different kinds of crimes. You will have the class of the Bernie Madoffs. They are billion-dollar criminals. And you have the lower rankings of people who commit crimes against property and crimes of violence. But when you act as if this is unique to one group of people, and you do this without paying attention to all of the pegs that this issue rests on, you're doing a great disservice. Michael from New Jersey, thank you for joining us. You're on the air.
Therese, well, first, Therese, I thought your commentary was brilliant. And also, it was very revealing of the kind of vast social confusion in which we all live, actually, today. And I also think your personal experience with regard to Colin Ferguson makes it even more compelling as a social commentary. And I also would like to say just generally that it's so refreshing to hear social commentary on on radio just at all, because it seems like the humanities in general have been so downgraded. We seem to be just a society that's taken over with, you know, technology and technocrats. So, and I think the more that happens, the more confusion socially we tend to live in. But also, I think to say that someone's will is determined by a reaction to social conditions, and in another case, an action is determined by some inner incoherence, is just part of the irrationality of all of this. All the cases are the same. They're just a reaction, and the only difference is it has to be racism, I would say. It's a different standard for different groups of people.
It's a different dynamic, and the dynamic was, that I was hoping to point out, was in the case of Colin Ferguson, here is a black man who killed white people. So there was no hope for him ever getting a shot at being considered a human being after that.
Well,
he committed
the
ultimate crime. The others, were white mass killers. And the almost automatic, in fact, even the media kind of hinted right away that the only logical explanation would have been that they were not in their right minds. It turns out that they were correct, but it was the automatic assumption.
Determined by the nature of the victims and the nature of the person who, or not the nature, but just who it was that racially that undertook the action. To say one person's insane, irrational reaction is different in status for the purpose of determining what kind of justice or treatment they're going to receive is in itself irrational and incoherent.
Yes, but it is. The thing is that is the reality that we live with, and you can't help but see it. You know, the dichotomy is so glaring.
Yes, in this instance, there can't be more contrast. You know, than you've given. It's stark, and it's so plain to see, and yet, you know, it's hardly commented on.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
It's a shame, and I think it also there needs to be more of this kind of social commentary that brings out the irrationality of just the way we, you know, in which we live.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, for your call. I got the hint. The music is coming up, which means it's time for us to say goodbye. I thank you very much for joining me today and look forward to getting back together with you again on Monday and hope that you have a good weekend. But we'll get into some debates as of next week and some new features on Lead Stories. Until then, take good care and stay tuned. Coming up next, you don't want to miss it. You don't want to miss it. Coming up next is Richard Martin and Wake Up Call.